The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated October 23, 2023. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Our 100th year is printed in the upper right-hand corner as if it were a thumbprint page-turning place. Time is in large capital block letters in a smoky gray-brown and superimposed upon a darker smoky gray-brown background, which is the wall of a room in which is seated a young girl named Gloria, 13. Gloria is dressed in a white dress with red trim and fringe on the hem. She's wearing a bracelet on her right hand. She appears to be sitting on a bed or divan or sofa, which is covered in either a throw or a spread or upholstery of a blue and cream and gray background. A small table is next to this piece of furniture, and on the wall behind Gloria, who has long, dark hair and bright, dark eyes, is an electrical outlet. Perhaps this is Gloria's room. Beginning with the first article, then, it's the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. How to weigh the risks of a crisis over Taiwan. In January, Taiwan will hold a presidential election. China's leaders hope former New Taipei City Mayor Hu Yue, candidate of the Kuomintang opposition party, will win the job. But the smart money is on current Vice President William Lai, or Lai, L-A-I, who represents the incumbent Democratic Progressive Party, DPP. Lai and his party favor a tougher approach to Beijing. If Lai wins, Beijing will become much more confrontational in the coming months. A Chinese invasion of Taiwan remains highly unlikely, but a deterioration in relations is bad news for both sides. For now, Beijing is wielding both sticks and carrots to influence Taiwan's voters. China's Navy recently conducted its largest ever military exercises in the Western Pacific. But Beijing has also announced a plan to develop China's Fujian province into a demonstration zone for integrated economic development with Taiwan. This good cop, bad cop strategy probably will not work. Recent polling suggests about three-quarters of Taiwan's 24 million people now consider themselves Taiwanese rather than Chinese, whatever their family history, a sharp jump over the past 10 years. Some of that trend is likely the natural product of generational change, but China's crackdown on the democracy rights movement in Hong Kong in 2020 has played a role in that shift, too. Meanwhile, Taiwan's DPP leaders are looking beyond the election toward the more threatening approach from China. Their latest pushback comes in the form of a new defense report they hope will make China think harder about a future invasion. September 12, Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense released its National Defense Report 2023, which details the lessons Taiwan has learned from Russia's war on Ukraine. In particular, the report calls for bolstering Taiwan's asymmetric warfare capabilities, including the acquisition of mobile, cost-effective, portable, and AI-enabled weapons and equipment. China has also learned lessons from the war in Ukraine. Its leaders recognize that an enemy fighting for its land can make territorial gain prohibitively expensive for the invader, and that Western powers are more likely to align than divide in the face of naked military aggression. It should also be clear for now that Beijing badly needs to focus its current attention and resources on domestic challenges. Over the longer term, China's President Xi Jinping remains determined to reincorporate Taiwan into China by any means necessary, and he will respond forcefully to any moves he considers foreign interference in this mission. But Beijing also understands Washington has domestic challenges too, and will not welcome any pro-independence push by anyone in Taiwan for the foreseeable future. That gives Beijing time to wait for better conditions for decisive action against the island's autonomy. From the View inbox, Health Matters by Haley Weiss, health and science reporter. Depending on whom you ask, Oregon and Washington have been either reckless or trailblazing. In 2021, both states decriminalized possession of all drugs, a highly experimental move amid a growing opioid crisis in the Pacific Northwest. Because no clear metric captures the dangers of drugs, measuring the impact of these bills is not so simple. Residents of both states, particularly in major cities like Seattle and Portland, have noticed dramatic increases in visible drug activity since the bills took effect. Quality of life challenges that have been well documented by local and national news outlets. Washington's decriminalization measure has since been rolled back. A pair of new studies, however, suggests that by other metrics in their first year, the measures may have begun to work as intended. According to an analysis by a team at NYU, neither bill caused any change in the already increasing numbers of fatal overdoses in each state. And promisingly, the decrease in arrests for drug possession led to no increase in arrests for violent crimes. There is always the hope states function as laboratories of democracy. When one state does something that makes sense and seems to work, that other states will adopt it, says Corey Davis, an assistant clinical professor at NYU's Center for Opioid Epidemiology and Policy, and a co-lead author on the papers. Arrests went way down. Overdoses did not change. To me, that is an improvement over the previously existing system. Perhaps, advocates suggest, Oregon's experiment just needs more time to breathe. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. As House Republicans convened their first hearing of an impeachment inquiry, nominally against President Joe Biden, it was pretty obvious their program was designed to agitate partisans, not persuade Americans. In fact, House Oversight Chairman James Comer all but confirmed as much during that September 27 session. "We want to present evidence," the Kentucky Republican said as the day began. Shot back, Representative Jamie Raskin, a Maryland Democrat who was a leading voice during both of the impeachment proceedings against Donald Trump. "What evidence? There's no evidence. There are no facts." Then Comer, perhaps not fully appreciating that he sounded like he was conceding the facts in this anti-Biden probe matter less than their packaging, responded, "Just sit back and let the American people see the hearing. Welcome to at least the next year of Congress, where how things look matters more than what they are." The first session offered no new evidence, just innuendo and character indictments. There is no sign that will change. To be clear, first son Hunter Biden may well have been involved in some dodgy deals that bordered on at least perceived criminality. Certainly there were some serious lapses in judgment as he banked on his family's name. Yet even the three witnesses invited by the Republican majority seemed dubious that the oversight team had the goods. Sham or not, though, this effort is here, and Republicans are going to use it to hammer Biden and fellow Democrats heading into a contentious and uncertain election year. Any serious impeachment investigation or inquiry relies on firsthand sworn testimony of witnesses to high crimes and misdemeanors, said Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. Today, the Republican majority has called three witnesses to make their case. She then asked each witness a version of the same question. Are you presenting any firsthand witness account of crimes committed by the President of the United States? The answer, of course, was negative. Not that it really mattered in D.C. Is the caption here. Ukraine shows how drones are changing warfare, by Eric Schmidt and Will Roper. There's a small inset photo here. It's in black and white because I think it's really in color, but the snowy ground and surroundings paint a very large white backdrop for a lone soldier dressed in camouflage, so this is not totally black. It's in the greenish, grayish, brownish, blackish colors. The soldier's arm is outstretched, and the caption reads, "A soldier with a drone in Bakhmut, Ukraine, in February." And flying just beyond his outstretched hand, or her outstretched hand, over the snowy field, is a drone. It looks like a bug. It looks like a large bug or a very miniature helicopter, but it has none of the rotor blades on top. There are four extensions from this little oblong apparatus, and on the end of each of the extensions is a little propeller blade. War spurs innovation. Observing life and death on Ukraine's battlefield, it is evident to us that modern warfare now transforms at startup speeds. This battlefield, interwoven with World War I-style trenches and a burgeoning fleet of adapted commercial drones, is tied together by everyday internet technology. The same software used by players to synchronize video game tactics now does so in a scenario with no pause nor reset button. This meshing of century-old tactics with state-of-the-art hobbyist tech, overlaid with the brutality of war, paints a harrowing portrait. We saw it in the eyes and streaming video feeds of the brave Ukrainian units hosting us on a front line amid their former homes and businesses, now serving as operations centers. ground troops with drones circling overhead know they are constantly under the watchful eyes of pilots a few kilometers away. Those pilots know they're potentially in crosshairs watching back. This feeling of exposure and lethal voyeurism is everywhere in Ukraine. Behind this front, commanders work in bunkers with internet connectivity that gives Ukraine a gamer's combat pace and the advantages of startup-like iteration. But during our visit this summer, it appeared this advantage was waning. Russia had adapted to Western weapons and Ukrainian techniques. Improved jamming and air defenses were increasingly grounding air power, putting more and more soldiers in the mud on a gridlocked front. For Ukraine, a breakthrough could lie in transforming their nascent drone startup ecosystem. Over 200 companies, many with affiliated combat units, into a continuously evolving software platform. As Russia showcases advancements like the Orlan 10 and Lancet drones, S-400 air defenses, and enhanced electronic warfare, all in seemingly inexhaustible quantities, Ukraine's response could be even faster evolving software that internetizes the battlefield with autonomy, AI, and ad hoc networking. Rather than new hardware, new software, and some clever tactics can hold the innovation high ground. Traditional militaries, with their slow procurement systems, have no playbook for this, but software startups do. Ukraine must win a startup war that constantly brings new systems and new software to the battlefield. At the heart of this strategy lies the drone, not just as an airborne device, but also as a potent software platform. Imagine drones that never miss, drones that never operate in isolation, drones with unbreakable communication lines, drones that in swarms always prevail, all possible with software, all changeable, all the time. Such a strategy would redefine warfare tactics by redefining its economics. En masse, low-cost drones may incapacitate million-dollar tanks or ships, creating a cost-exchange ratio that can bankrupt Russia's military and light Ukraine's path to victory. This cost-imposition warfare will render obsolete many traditional military concepts and alter the global security and landscape. The rapid, software-driven nature of these systems will also accelerate the onset of AI-powered warfare. This technological leap, fully separating the human attacker from their target, foretells a redefinition of warfare and deterrence, one where mass, low-cost data and algorithms dominate offense, empowering attributable systems that make defense increasingly unaffordable. The specter of a never-ending AI arms race demands new modes of diplomacy to prevent escalatory threats. But progress cannot be stopped, only guided. Unlike another autonomous weapon, landmines that kill civilians daily in Ukraine, lethal drones must be locatable, limited in autonomous duration, overseen by humans. All things software can ensure if guided by convention. As the cycle time of war quickens, so must every function supporting it, and so must the functions that deter it, from public debate to international laws and policies. Will the world rise to this challenge? We hope so, just as we hope for victory in Ukraine. Eric Schmidt and Will Roper, the authors, are noted here as Schmidt being the co-founder of Schmidt Futures. Roper is a former Assistant Secretary of the Air Force, now serving on the Pentagon's Innovation Board, and a distinguished professor at Georgia Tech. From the World heading, the human toll of Poland's strict abortion laws. Since a 2020 ruling by the country's constitutional tribunal, Poland has had a near-total ban on abortion. There have been mass women-led protests ever since. The consequences of the reproductive rights rollback have been dire, as doctors hesitate to take life-saving steps for pregnant patients. Krzysztof Zawinski still cries every day since his wife Marta, who was 5 months pregnant, died of sepsis in 2022. He believes doctors waited to act until the fetus's heart had stopped. Janusz Kaczarski also lost his partner, Justyna, to sepsis in the fifth month of pregnancy. She left behind two boys. With doctors reluctant to intervene, infant mortality rates have also risen. We've seen an increase in infant deaths in the statistics, says Dr. Gisela Jagielska, a gynecologist in Olesnica, who performs many of the few legal abortions that still take place in Poland. A recent patient, 6 months pregnant, traveled 250 miles to see her. The baby had almost no lung tissue. It would have died immediately or a few hours after birth, Jagielska says. Because the ruling law and Justice Party supports the restrictions, many Poles look to the October 15 parliamentary elections to produce change. Others look to the courts. Attorney Jolanta Wojcicka is representing families in criminal negligence cases against doctors in relation to the abortion law. That column was written by Anna Pamula. The Brief Health. This is by Angela Haupt. Five ways to tap into nostalgia's health benefits. When people walk into Carrie Peel's retro toy store in Albuquerque, New Mexico, their eyes light up. Wooden spinning tops, yo-yos, trolls, rainbow lava lamps, scratch and sniff stickers. It's like time travel unlocked. Some visitors make a beeline for the games and puzzles, eager to relive their glory days. I sell a ton of jacks to grandparents, Peel says. I always joke that I should have an over 50 league because every single grandma tells me they were the best at jacks. Indulging in this sort of nostalgia offers a host of well-being benefits, experts say. Research suggests yearning for the past helps us feel more connected to other people while increasing our ability to offer emotional support. Nostalgia can also help us find meaning in life, build self-esteem, focus more on being true to ourselves, plus it can make us happier. Interestingly, it is as much about building a better future as it is the past, experts say. Originally, I said, okay, the best way to think about nostalgia is it is this psychological defense mechanism. When life is uncertain and unstable, we look to the certainty and comfort of the past, and that makes us feel better, notes researcher Clay Routledge, whose book, Past Forward, How Nostalgia Can Help You Live a More Meaningful Life, will be published in December. And that is definitely true. But he's also discovered something surprising. When people share nostalgic memories, many are future-oriented. It's looking backwards, Routledge says, but it's because you want ideas for how to move forward. We asked Routledge and other experts to share their favorite ways to tap into nostalgia's benefits. Five here. One, watch old movies. Developmental molecular biologist John Medina sets out to bathe in nostalgic warmth for an hour a day, often watching old Disney movies that he and his mom enjoyed together when he was growing up, Fantasia, Pinocchio, Sleeping Beauty. "That's my happy place," he says. Follow Medina's lead and seek out the movies that remind you of a joyful time in your life. Even better, watch them or discuss them with someone else, he recommends. 2. Dine like you did as a kid. In need of dinner plans, load up your plate with a cafeteria-style Sloppy Joe and some Pop Rocks and Pixie Sticks, and pair it with a nice glass of purple Kool-Aid, Medina suggests. If anyone asks, call it the Nostalgia Special. Some research shines light on the idea of food nostalgia. Scents, in particular, can evoke nostalgia while also increasing self-esteem, optimism, and feelings of meaning in life. 3. Create some playlists. Research suggests people prefer music that was popular when they were in their teens and 20s to songs from before or after that time in their lives. Spend part of your day listening to whatever gets you grooving, or better yet, Routledge notes, make a playlist of your favorites. That's an example of something that requires a little more active creativity. He says, you're not just listening to nostalgic music, you're intentionally engaging with it. 4. Hit the books. When Peel and her husband started dating, they visited the children's section at the local library and shared their long-ago favorites with each other. She favored James Marshall's books, including the George and Martha series. He preferred books by Chris Van Allsburg, especially The Garden of Abdul Ghazazi. It was a really cool, fun way to learn about the other person, she recalls, and easily replicated at your own local library. 5. Start a collection. Medina often advises people to start collecting things. The earlier in life, the better. That way, when it comes time for you to retire, you'll have a bunch of objects you can fill a room with, and then just go and sit in as if you were in a hot tub, he says, a hot tub for the mind. Objects can uniquely help conjure the past. Plus, collecting is active and social. You might find yourself combing through antique shops or flea markets and interacting with those you encounter along the way. Brainstorm what you're interested in. Vintage Coke bottles, antique dishes, Barbies, train sets, and have fun embarking on your scavenger hunt. Next Generation Leaders. This is a small series that Time has going on right now. And this is the first, 10 Trailblazers Offering New Visions for the Future. It may be the only one you hear, but it is the longer and the lead article in this section. Scotland, Humza, H-U-M-Z-A, Yousaf, Y-O-U-S-A-F, Championing a New Kind of Nationalism. This article was written by Yasmin Serhan. On the afternoon of March 28, Humza Yousaf entered Butte House. That's B-U-T-E. The four-story Georgian townhouse in Edinburgh that serves as the official residence of the First Minister of Scotland. Earlier that day, he'd been elected to that position by his peers in the Scottish Parliament, making him the first Muslim politician to lead a Western democracy, as well as the first non-white and youngest Scottish leader. He gazed up at a series of 6 portraits in the stairwell, the first of Donald Dewar, who became the inaugural First Minister in 1999, the fifth of Yousaf's predecessor, Nicola Sturgeon, Scotland's longest-serving leader. The final portrait was of a grinning Yusuf, sporting a trademark tartan tie. I really stand out because I look different, the 38-year-old recalls, when we meet 5 months later in St. Andrew's House, the headquarters of the Scottish government. It was really emotional. I remember looking at it and thinking, almost whatever happens now, mine will always be the one that looks different. As proud as Yusuf is to have broken these barriers, he says it is not something he dwells on. Perhaps because there are too many other pressing issues. His early tenure has coincided with one of the most difficult periods in the 89-year history of the ruling separatist Scottish National Party. Since Sturgeon's shock resignation in February, a decision that she attributed in part to burnout, the SNP has been plagued by an ongoing police investigation into its finances, internal divisions, uncertainty over how to achieve its overriding objective, for Scotland to end its centuries-old union with the UK and become an independent country. The last time Scots had their say on independence in 2014, 55% voted against it. The British government, which established the autonomous Scottish legislature in 1999, is adamant that a vote not be repeated any time soon. Scotland is also struggling in other ways, from a cost-of-living crisis to overwhelmed public services. These issues will likely dominate the UK-wide general election expected next year, in which Yusuf's SNP, in power in Scotland for 16 years, may now be vulnerable. The SNP is the largest party in the Scottish Parliament and thus leads the Scottish government and claims the majority of Scottish seats in the UK Parliament in Westminster. Some polls project the SNP could lose as many as half its Westminster seats to the ascendant Labour Party. Also at stake is Yusuf's own authority within the SNP if it is seen to lose its electoral edge. I think there's a job to do for us in those 12 to 15 months to make sure we're re-earning the trust of the people of Scotland, he says. It is going to be a tough job. Yusuf may not be as easily recognizable as his predecessor, who had been the face of Scottish politics for nearly a decade, but on a cloudy August afternoon in the Scottish seaside town of Largs, L-A-R-G-S, he's hard to miss, flanked by an entourage as he makes his way along the seafront, ice cream cone in hand. During an interview with a local journalist, Yusuf is so engrossed in discussing his plans to shore up the economy, he barely seems to register the drops of salted caramel falling onto his black dress shoes. While most politicians use their summer recess to return to their constituencies or take a vacation, Yusuf spent his on a summer tour of independence across Scotland to boost SNP morale after a bruising few months in the media and polls. As much as the tour was about rallying support for independence, it was also ostensibly about reintroducing Yusuf to the SNP faithful. Not that Yusuf necessarily needs an introduction. He spent more than a decade in frontline Scottish politics, and even longer within the broader separatist movement. Born in 1985 in Glasgow, Yusuf grew up at a time when the SNP was not the electoral force it would become. But the party's long been central to his family life. His father, Muzaffar Yusuf, joined the SNP in 1972 after having immigrated to Scotland from Pakistan in the 1960s. and Humzah is married to Nadia El-Nakla, a Scot of Palestinian descent, who's a local SNP councillor in Dundee. The couple have a 4-year-old daughter, and Yusuf is stepfather to a 14-year-old daughter from Nadia's previous marriage. Yusuf says, despite being one of only 2 non-white pupils in his elementary school, he did not feel all that different from his peers, with 2 exceptions. The first was when, at the age of 6, he was referred to by one classmate as a Paki, P-A-K-I, a racist term hurled at South Asians. The second was in the aftermath of 9/11, when a 16-year-old Yusuf found himself bombarded by questions from friends about the perpetrators and their motives. That, to me, was an important moment, because my Muslim identity came to the fore, partly because people were questioning it, were asking about what it meant in terms of my loyalty to this country, Yusuf says. It's also the moment he credits as a catalyst for his decision to pursue a career in politics, one that made his mother, Shaista Bhutta, nervous. She said, "What kind of job are you going to get in politics?" She would not need to wait long to find out. Within days of the SNP's historic victory in the 2007 Scottish Parliament elections, during which Yusuf balanced campaigning for the SNP with studying for his final exams at the University of Glasgow, where he earned a degree in politics, he accepted a job as a parliamentary assistant for SNP lawmaker Bashir Ahmad. 4 years later, Yusuf was elected to Scottish Parliament and soon after kicked off his career of firsts, becoming the youngest lawmaker to join Scotland's cabinet at age 27 in 2012. He went on to serve variously as Transport, Justice, and Health Minister. Yusuf's extensive ministerial experience made him an early front runner in the race to succeed Sturgeon. As the continuity candidate, he was also seen by many SNP figures as best placed to continue her record of electoral success. But the party's fortunes have long since nosedived. The investigation into his finances, which concerns allegations that the SNP misused £600,000, $750,000 in donations earmarked to campaign for a second independence referendum, continues to loom over the party. The fractious contest to replace Sturgeon also exposed internal SNP divisions. The party's flagging in the polls has prompted some to question whether Yusuf is truly up to the task. John Curtis, C-U-R-T-I-C-E, a polling expert and political scientist at the University of Strathclyde, says Yusuf lacks the popularity of his predecessor and perhaps some of her charisma. "He cannot command people in the way Sturgeon could," he says. Indeed, Yusuf claimed the support of just 52% of the party's 72,000 dues-paying members, compared with SNP leadership rival Kate Forbes's 48%. That was a terribly narrow result, Curtis adds. SNP lawmakers who spoke with Time have downplayed the scale of the party's internal divisions, but it is an issue that's rattled the party enough that Yusuf told a room of party activists in Largs that he couldn't give a flying monkeys who they voted for during the leadership contest, only that they put those differences aside in pursuit of the independence cause. "Divided parties just don't win elections," he warns. There's a small photo here in color. Scottish National Party, Largs and District Office, is a big sign in gold and black above a storefront. It's number 6 somewhere because a crowd of people are entering that doorway. Yet Yusof is greeting supporters outside the SNP office in Largs, Scotland, August 23, reads the caption. Most of the folks he's greeting are senior citizens, men and women. There is a long-haired younger woman, probably, her back is to the camera, in the foreground of the photo. Yusof himself looks, in this photo, compared with others in the photo, tall. He has dark hair, closely groomed, facial hair, closely groomed, wearing a dark jacket, khaki pants, and apparently those are the black dress shoes that he spilled ice cream onto. Returning now to the text, if Yusof is worried about the SNP's future, or his own, he does not show it. Over the course of our two-hour meeting, he's relaxed, stealing sips of coffee, cracking jokes. During a photo shoot, while maintaining a solemn expression, he says, I think I'm giving what my daughter would call bombastic side eye. But behind his jovial demeanor, there's also a seriousness. As we sit down away from the cameras, he acknowledges it's been a rocky start. We've had five of the most difficult months that my party has probably faced, and certainly its recent history, he says. On this, even some of his toughest critics agree. Just days before our conversation, Forbes said she dodged a bullet by losing to Yusof. How then does he plan to turn things around? Principally, he says, by giving Scots a bold and progressive alternative to his Labour and Conservative opponents, which he describes as two sides of the same unionist coin. I want to see the back of the Conservatives, Yusof says of UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's party, whose right-wing politics has long served as an ideal contrast to the SNP's vision for a social democratic Scotland. At the same time, I despair at the lack of leadership shown by Sir Keir Starmer, citing the centre-left Labour Party leader's unwillingness to reverse Conservative welfare policies or Brexit, which most Scots opposed. The SNP advocates Scotland's rejoining the EU. But unlike with the Conservatives, who Yusof says have governed the UK with incompetence and at times cruelty over the past 13 years, Yusof says the more left-leaning SNP would be willing to strike a deal with Labour to get the Conservatives out, albeit for a price, a fresh independence vote. A hung parliament in which Labour does not win enough seats to form a government on its own would almost certainly be the best-case scenario for the SNP to try to force another referendum. The UK Supreme Court ruled in 2022 Scotland does not have the power to legislate for one on its own. But current polls suggest Labour is on track to win a majority. Still, Yusof is doubling down on his independence pitch as the next UK election looms, not only because it is the core policy that unites his big tent party, but also because he sees it as the solution to the most pressing issues facing Scots today. On the economy, healthcare, education, and more, Scotland is faring poorly. Yusof says an independent Scotland would, of course, have challenges, but it would also have avoided what he calls the failures of Westminster, including Britain's departure from the EU. Yet support for independence remains at a steady 48%, and a June survey by British pollster YouGov found that when asked to list their top priorities, Scots chose healthcare, the economy, education. Independence came in seventh. People are exhausted after 10 years of constitutional politics, both in terms of Scottish independence, but also Brexit. Then the COVID years, now high inflation and cost of living, says Alex Massey, an Edinburgh-based columnist for the Times of London. Yusof, tasked with defending the SNP's record, says he is attuned. After that long in government, it's inevitable that you make mistakes. A week after we spoke, Yusof led thousands on an independent march. That's Independence March through the streets of Edinburgh, where he framed the cost of living crisis as a cost of union crisis. Whether that message will be enough to keep voters on side remains to be seen, but he's staking his historic leadership on it. Being attached to this unequal union, he says, is what's holding us back. Time off the 100 best mystery and thriller books of all time. The genre's most gripping, twist-filled, satisfying, influential books in chronological order. Now, I'm not going to read all 100 of this. This is by Tana French. It's an essay, a satisfying, mystifying thrill. I was 6 when I fell in love with mysteries. Some school book had a not very accurate comprehension page about the Mary Celeste, a ship that was found drifting in the Atlantic in 1872, intact, a meal, still cooking in the galley, with the crew, passengers, and lifeboat missing, never to be seen again. I was totally enthralled. I can still remember lying on the living room rug with the book, promising myself when I died I would ask God for the answer. I could probably trace a direct line from that moment through all the fictional and real mysteries I have devoured since then to where I am today. Mystery books for me divide themselves into two kinds. One kind, Agatha Christie, Sherlock Holmes, is all about restoring order. The central questions concern concrete facts. Who did it? How did they do it? Truth in these stories is an objective thing, and answers are solid and definitive. By the end of the book, every baffling clue connects up to the others, and the killer's motive is clear. Good is separated from evil. Guilty are locked up, dead or at least identified. And the innocent are free to move on with their lives. These books sometimes get dismissed as formulaic or simplistic, but they are a lot more than that. In a world that can often be chaotic and reasonless, we need these stories. During the first COVID shutdown, I was popping Agatha Christie's like Smarties, and I talked to a bookseller who said they could not keep her novels in stock. We need to believe that sometimes things can fit together and make sense, even when that seems impossible, that someday our crisis will end and we'll be able to leave it behind. The clean resolution offered in the structure of these books, A kills B, C finds out who done it, makes perfect the mystery genre to speak for the hard-won triumph of order and meaning. But there are also the wild mysteries. In these books, the questions are left unanswered. Maybe the killer stays uncaught, or the process of solving the mystery leads to more upheaval instead of less, or the solution works against justice rather than bringing it to fruition. In wild mysteries, order is not restored, because order is not the point. Truth is not objective and solid. It is dark, slippery, double-edged. Good cannot be neatly separated from evil. The crucial questions are not questions of fact. They are more nebulous and tangled than that. What are we capable of? How much of who we are is determined by choice, by circumstance, by nature? How do we respond to things that seem impossible to cope with? The questions stay unanswered because they are unanswerable. Mystery is also the perfect genre for exploring these tensions. It deals with the highest stakes, truth and justice, life and death, and with the most complicated twists of the human mind, the processes by which a person takes the transformative and irrevocable step to murder. When we fall in love with mysteries, it's both those things we're falling in love with, the hard-won sense of order, and the unanswerable questions. The list does a magnificent job of covering those bases from every possible angle. Books like Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd and Rudolph Fischer's The Conjure Man Dies give us the pure satisfaction of watching the pieces fall perfectly into place, while Louise Erdick's The Roundhouse and Dennis Lehane's Mystic River cry out against the utterly ineffectuality of solutions and so-called justice in the face of a crime's shattering impact. In Patricia Highsmith's The Talented Mr. Ripley, the protagonist is the mystery, one that can be explored but never solved. The Secret History by Donna Tartt and We Have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson create worlds where no answers can ever stack up against the overwhelming sense of the unknown. And Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose exuberantly does all of it at once, neatly tying up every question of fact while also firing out bigger questions in every direction. I have found, luckily, without having to die first, a tentative answer to the Mary Celeste mystery. The ship was carrying a cargo of barrels of alcohol. If some of those were leaking, the fumes could have made the crew think the ship was in danger of exploding, so everyone headed for the lifeboat, tying it to the ship so they could get back on board if and when it was safe, except the rope came untied, and they drifted off. It is a plausible solution. It fits all the facts neatly and satisfyingly, but I have to admit I liked the story better before when the possibilities ran wild. Okay, here are at least some of those 100 best mystery and thriller books of all time, decided upon by a panel. 1860, The Woman in White. 1867, Crime and Punishment. 1878, The Leavenworth Case. 1898, The Turn of the Screw. 1902, The Hound of the Baskerville. I am not reading all of the authors, but maybe I should. 1929, The Crime at Black Dudley by Marjorie Allingham. 1929, The Patient in Room 18 by Mignon G. Eberhardt. 1930, The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett. 1932, The Conjure Man Dies by Rudolph Fischer. 1934, A Man Lay Dead by Ngaio Marsh. 1935, Gaudy Night by Dorothy L. Sayers. 1935, The Three Coffins by John Dixon Carr. 1938, Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. 1939, A Coffin for Demetrios by Eric Ambler. 1943, Double Indemnity by James M. Cain. 1947, In a Lonely Place by Dorothy B. Hughes. 1951, The Daughter of Time by Josephine Tey, T-E-Y. 1952, Beat Not the Bones by Charlotte J. 1953, Casino Royale by Ian Fleming. 1953, A Kiss Before Dying by Ira Levin. 1953, The Long Goodbye by Raymond Chandler. 1955, Beast in View by Margaret Miller, M-I-L-L-A-R. 1955, The Quiet American by Graham Greene. 1955, The Talented Mr. Ripley by Patricia Highsmith. 1962, We've Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson. There are a couple out of order here because they're in little boxes highlighted. The first of those is The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie from 1926, and then from 1945, If He Hollers, Let Him Go by Chester Himes, H-I-M-E-S. Skipping ahead now recklessly to the 2000s. 2005, this is another highlighted title, The Devotion of Suspect X by Keigo Higashino. From 2009, another highlighted title, Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead by Olga Tokarczuk. 2010, Bury Your Dead by Louise Penny, also highlighted. 2001, The Surgeon by Tess Gerritsen. 2002, The Emperor of Ocean Park by Stephen L. Carter. 2002, Fingersmith by Sarah Waters. 2003, The Ice Princess by Camilla Lackberg. 2004, 2666 by Roberto Bolaño. 2004, Case Histories by Kate Atkinson. 2005, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson. 2005, The Lincoln Lawyer by Michael Connelly. 2006, Snakeskin Shamisen by Naomi Hirahara. 2007, Queenpin by Megan Abbott. 2007, What the Dead Know by Laura Lippman. 2007, The Yiddish Policeman's Union by Michael Chabon. 2009, Wife of the Gods by Quay Quarty. 2010, Faithful Place by Tana French, who wrote the essay. 2010, The Plotters by Eun-Soo Kim. 2011, The Sound of Things Falling by Juan Gabriel Vasquez. 2012, Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. 2012, The Round House by Louise Erdrich. 2012, 6-4 by Hideo Yokoyama. 2013, Ordinary Grace by William Kent Krieger. 2014, Big Little Lies by Leon Moriarty. And 2014, Everything I Never Told You by Celeste Ng. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.